From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Special hello tonight to Paul Gomez out there near Spain. He's on Gibraltar. He's an avid Coast to Coast listener. Thank you, Paul. Also tonight, you will hear some different bumper music from other countries. Not every break, but most of them. And then later tonight, we'll have open lines for you. Here's what's happening. Hillary Clinton, apparently, they say, is healthy and fit to serve as U.S. president, according to her doctor, as her campaign has released some updated medical information now. The statement said the Democratic presidential nominee continues to improve after a pneumonia diagnosis. The campaign also said that Mrs. Clinton's physician found her completely normal and she's in excellent mental condition. Clinton aides say she will return to the campaign trail on Thursday. The doctor said Mrs. Clinton, who's 68, was recovering well with antibiotics and rest. We shall see. Now, what else is going on with the presidential campaign? I thought for just a moment we would bring in Linda Sherman, the world-renowned astrologer, to talk a little bit about Hillary and Donald Trump. Hi, Linda. Thanks for coming on tonight.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be on your show, George.
Let's talk about Hillary first. Astrologically speaking, what do you see?
Well, astrologically speaking, Hillary's chart has had an extremely tough time. She is in just a day, she will have an eclipse on her natal moon. It's been very, very difficult. I would say if she can get past the first week of October, her chart looks like it has a chance to rally.
And when you say get by, you mean what?
Well, there is a lunar, when you have a lunar eclipse on your natal moon, this is very difficult. It is an aspect that points, again, to health issues,
okay,
to problems. Again, Hillary Clinton is a Scorpio with Mercury squared to her stellium of planets in Leo. And Hillary is hiding things even when she doesn't have to hide them. She's a very, very defensive person by nature. And she's had reason to defend herself. She's been the most beaten up person in history.
Oh, sure. So she's not out of the woods yet, but if she can get into October, things will be better for her.
If things are going to get better for her. When Mars goes into Capricorn, which subsidizes her chart, and Mercury gets out of Virgo by the second week of October, the Mercury, which has been retrograde in Virgo, has been very not positive in her chart at all.
And how about Donald Trump?
And Donald Trump, I have said for some time, he has survived every difficult transit in this campaign that he's been through. Difficulties where people have thrown things at him, which have criticized him. His chart is, frankly, fairly positive. He could win this election, and people... I've been among the very few people who said that in the astrological community. I think it's going to be very close, and I cannot predict the winner at this point. I can only say that Hillary's chart gets a little bit better in October, early November than it has been.
And Donald stays pretty constant?
Donald has a lot going for him, but I will say the Mars in Capricorn is going to make it a little bit more difficult for him. But he survived difficulties. Donald Trump, with Mars on his ascendant, is a focus for rage. They don't care that he flip-flops and lies and tells a different story every 10 minutes and is unqualified, really, to be president in any sense, except that he has the right under the Constitution. But he has survived just about everything. Uranus, Jupiter are all in good positions in his chart. I think this is going to be a fight to the finish between the two of them.
All right. We will check in with you later on, Linda, and see what happens. Linda's astrological reports on Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and her specific comments are her own views, obviously. The Department of Justice has issued subpoenas to Wells Fargo over the opening of millions of fake accounts at the bank. Multiple U.S. attorneys' offices now are investigating. The investigation is still in the early stages. Not clear if it'll lead to charges. News of the federal investigation comes less than a week after Wells Fargo was slapped with a $185 million fine by regulators for creating more than 2 million fake bank and credit cards accounts. Wells Fargo also said it had fired 5,300 people over the past couple years due to improper sales tactics there. St. Louis-based Monsanto, the American maker of fertilizers, agriculture products, GMO seeds, has agreed to a takeover by Bayer, the German chemical conglomerate, for $56 billion after months of negotiations and assumption of debt makes it a $66 billion deal. Bayer will acquire Monsanto for $128 per share in cash. It could take about a year for regulators to approve this deal, but let's bring in Jeffrey Smith, author of Genetic Roulette. What does this mean to the future of GMOs, Jeffrey?
Well, it would create the world's biggest seed and pesticide company. But what's happening right now is that there's two desperate companies looking to try and find solace in each other. Bayer's pharmaceutical pipeline is drying up, and they're looking to invest in some other source of revenue. But Monsanto's core business is teetering. I was interviewed by German television in St. Louis last week, and I've also sent a letter to Bayer's supervisory board of directors this week, telling them that they should revalue Monsanto downward because they're ignoring the fact that their GMOs and Roundup are failing in the field with super weeds and super bugs, that Roundup being declared a probable human carcinogen by the World Health Organization is being rejected around the world by countries and commercial institutions, and that the replacement of Roundup, the dicamba, turns out to be a very dangerous thing for Monsanto because it's already damaged 200,000 acres of nearby farmland because it can volatilize and fly through the air and then relocate and destroy the farmers' crops. Also, in the United States, the GMO future is shaky as Hershey's, Campbell's, Del Monte, General Mills, Red Gold, Danone, Similac, etc., are all pushing out non-GMO products. Nestle's is even advertising on TV that their coffee creamer is non-GMO, and this means that the future of GMOs and Roundup, which is what Monsanto is leveraged on, that is the main source of their income, those things are at risk, and I think that by throwing Monsanto a lifeline, it may pull down Bayer.
There are 4,100 employees of Monsanto in the St. Louis area, Jeffrey, and a lot of them are pretty darn scared about this merger takeover.
And a lot of people in who are Bayer shareholders can't believe that the company wants to purchase Monsanto, which is consistently voted the most hated or most evil company in the world. That's not just in the United States. That's also around Europe. So a lot of people who are associated with Bayer are also very angry.
So this deal's not a done deal yet, then?
No, it's supposed to be finished by the end of 2017, but they have to pass at least two hurdles, an approval by the shareholders of Bayer and approval by the Justice Department. And because Monsanto's already been investigated as a monopoly on its own, when they combine with Bayer, it's even a greater problem for potential price controls, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, thanks, Jeffrey. Authorities say a southern Indiana man passed over for a coaching and teaching position mailed 4 dead skunks and a dead raccoon to the successful applicant. Nice guy, huh? 40-year-old man was charged in court with 2 counts of stalking, intimidation, criminal mischief. He's being held without bond. A coroner says a heart found in a plastic bag on the ground next to an Ohio gas station appears to be human. Pathologists are looking at it now and testing it. They have no idea how it got there or why. Now, you might remember when he was on our program some time ago, we talked about Dr. Mary's monkey. Ed Haslam is back with us, and we're going to be talking about more of his work and its bizarre tie-in to the Kennedy assassination. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Ed Haslam back with us. I'm going to read the title of the book he has. You get a better perspective of what we're going to talk about with him for the first couple hours tonight. Dr. Mary's Monkey, How the Unsolved Murder of a Doctor, a Secret Laboratory in New Orleans, and Cancer-Causing Monkey Virus are linked to Lee Harvey Oswald and the emerging global epidemics. Ed is back on Coast to Coast. Ed, always a pleasure. How are you?
I'm fine, George. Thanks. Happy to be back.
You and I are going to get together in October in New Orleans at the major Lee Harvey Oswald conference on the Kennedy assassination.
That's right. Looking forward to that.
That's going to be fun. And that, of course, is the impetus for some of the things you've done. Ed, I want you to take us back a little bit. Tell us about Dr. Mary's monkey, who we're talking about here, Mary Sherman. What happened to her and this tie-in?
Well, Mary Sherman was a doctor in New Orleans, but she was really a world-class expert in radiation and cancer out of the University of Chicago. And in 1964, she was found in her apartment, bizarrely murdered. And there was a cover-up. And by cover-up, I mean they did not tell the public what happened to her. And what happened to her was her arm and rib cage got disintegrated by heat. And, you know, like there's nothing in the apartment that could have done that. And I had a contact with Mary Sherman. She was a good friend of my father. They both taught in the same department at Tulane Medical School together. And so this was something I learned about as a child. I sat on her lap as a child and stuff. And the question was, what really happened to her? And when I got my hands on the documents, and by that I mean autopsy, homicide reports, police reports, all that stuff, I realized that there was nothing in her apartment that could have done the damage to her. So I got into researching this. Who was she? What was she working on? And why didn't they tell the public about her missing arm? And that was because they didn't want people going around uptown New Orleans looking for an extremely powerful electronic device that could have burned off her arm. This thing became a rabbit hole. And the more I got into it, the more I started saying, well, who did this person work for and all that? And we were looking at New Orleans at the height of the Cold War, all this anti-Castro stuff going on there. We wind up with Lee Harvey Oswald in the middle of it. They're developing a biological weapon by mutating monkey viruses, trying to kill Fidel Castro. And it just becomes this horribly complex, very real world political situation where we discover there's a back door to what was going on with Oswald in New Orleans. And that's what we're really talking about in this Oswald conference. Is he was in New Orleans for 5 months, from the end of April to the end of September, and very few people know anything about what he was doing there at the time. And when you realize, it's kind of like what you know about what he was doing in New Orleans tells you what's wrong with the whole story in Dallas. This guy is not a lone nut. He's an intelligence operative. He's working with a bunch of people. He's helping develop a biological weapon. He's trying to kill Fidel Castro. And if you're doing all that, you're not a lone nut and you're not a communist. And so what I'm doing is I'm pulling together what I know from my book, Dr. Mary's Monkey. And one of the other things I did was I edited Me and Lee by Judith Vary Baker.
Great. I know her.
Yeah, which is about the 5 months that he was there. I mean, that's the center of the book. And then we get some other books like Chauncey Holt's book. And Chauncey was a member of Operation Mongoose and worked for Meyer Lansky and the CIA. And he's there in this famous photo of Oswald handing out the leaflets in front of the ITM, which we'll talk about a little bit later, because that's the photo that's got Rafael Cruz in it. And so this whole thing becomes the back door to understanding Oswald, but it was a back door that was left open and nobody thought we'd ever get into. And when you realize what Oswald was doing there and who he was working with, you'll see that it all involves Mary Sherman. We have witnesses who saw Oswald in Mary Sherman's apartment doing strange things like flushing toilets over and over again. I'll talk more about that. But that's why we're doing this whole conference in New Orleans instead of in Dallas, you know, because if you start off with Dallas and and Oswald starting off in a defensive position about the assassination
sure.
and stuff. When you get to New Orleans, Oswald's from New Orleans. He's connected.
Well, he was born there, right?
He was born there in 1939. His family was connected with Carlos Marcello and the mafia there. I mean, there's all this interesting stuff. And then, we've got this conference. I mean, I'm not the only person talking. I mean, in addition to you and me, they've got Jim Mars, Roger Stone, Judith Very Baker, Sean Stone, who's Oliver's son, St. John Hunt, and of course, my favorite radio talk show host, George Norrie.
this situation, this entire situation with Oswald, where he said he was a patsy, and I've always believed that. Do you believe that too?
Oh, absolutely. And when you look at these 5 months, you realize, you know, like there's a scene in the Titanic when the ship hits the iceberg. you know, it's kind of, it drives the plot from that point forward. Oswald knows by July 29th, he knows that he has penetrated a group that's very serious about killing Kennedy. And they have asked him to do all this stuff in August to make him look like a communist. And they're telling him, oh, that's so we can get you into Cuba. But Oswald's no dummy. He's saying, wait a second. If they're going to kill Kennedy, they got to blame it on somebody, and they're setting me up to look like a communist. So Oswald knows from the latter part of July that they're setting him up. And he is just, you know, he can't get out is the problem. But he knows very early on, and so when he says he's a patsy, I mean, he was showing people around Daley Plaza, you know, talking to them about, you know, where they might want to.
But he knew all the players.
He knew all the players, which is why they had to get rid of him. I mean, that's the big point. You know, I mean, yes, Kennedy got killed. Kings are killed. Politics is power. But what happened when they killed Oswald, they murdered Oswald in a police station in front of the cameras. That is the total failure of our justice system.
Oh, my God, it collapsed. And it was the next day.
Yeah, well, 2 days later. Yeah, it was Sunday morning. But it's, you know, it.
Yeah, 2 days later.
To me, and why Bobby Kennedy didn't sweep in, and you know, he should have sent marshals down there and kind of taken over the situation. I mean, the whole thing just kind of collapsed at that point. And to me, that's as big of an issue as shooting Kennedy. And so if you say, well, who is this guy, Oswald? You know, and what was he doing? You realize that he was involved in a project to develop a biological weapon, which they tested on live prisoners at a state-owned facility in Jackson, Louisiana. And you start to get into those details, you realize, and we got witnesses. You know, we have Judith Very Baker, who is in Mary Sherman's apartment with Lee Oswald, who said Lee Oswald was a support person who is, you know, I mean, when you let's look at what happens when Oswald shows up in New Orleans. Oswald has not been in New Orleans for 10 years.
Where was he living during all of this? Was he living in Dallas or was he sent to Dallas?
Well, he was in Dallas-Fort Worth for a while and then lived in Dallas for a while. And then at the end of April, all of a sudden, you know, he's told, you're going to New Orleans, you know. And he hands his wife and baby to Ruth Payne and says, you know, take care of these, my family, and drive them to New Orleans after a while. I got to go now. Well, that's awfully sudden, you know.
Sure is.
And what happened was, you know, Judith Very Baker was told to show up in New Orleans second week of May, and she shows up in late April and starts shooting off her mouth. And then they got to get somebody in there fast to get a hold of her. And Oswald, you know, he arrives on the 25th, okay? On the 26th, the next day, he intercepts Judith Very Baker at the post office and starts speaking Russian to her, okay? The following day, the 26th, he introduces Judith Very Baker to David Ferry, and they discuss Mary Sherman. 2 days later, there's a party at David Ferry's house, and Mary Sherman shows up. And then a couple of days later, when Ochsner gets back in town, it's Lee Oswald that sets up the meeting between Judy and Ochsner, and he goes in by himself. This is Lee Oswald going in to talk to Alton Ochsner by himself in the bowels of Charity Hospital before Judith goes in. I mean, Oswald, this is his first week in town in 10 years.
Yeah, they're all connected. Stay with us, Ed. We're going to come back in just a moment and talk more about this intriguing, strange relationship. Ed, welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're back with Ed Heslam and his book, Dr. Mary's Monkey. Let's talk a little bit about this secret laboratory, Ed, if you would. It was in New Orleans. Who put it together? Who established it?
Well, it goes through two phases. The first phase was when they realized that there was a cancer-causing monkey virus in the polio vaccine. And what they wanted to do was try to develop an anti-cancer vaccine, and they were in a great big hurry. And so they were going to use radiation to mutate these monkey viruses to, in hopes of developing an anti-cancer vaccine. This happens, they start this in 1959. So by 1960-61, they've actually set up this secret laboratory in New Orleans where they have a linear particle accelerator, and they're doing this research. And then in 62, what happens is you wind up with the Cuban Missile Crisis. You got Russian nuclear missiles in Cuba, and everybody freaks out. And New Orleans is within the strike zone of these intermediate-range missiles. And so the mission of this laboratory gets changed right there as they move into 1963, because, you know, Cuban Missile Crisis is fall of 62. And they decided that they're going to ramp up the mutations that they're getting to become more aggressive and develop a biological weapon that can be injected into people to give them cancer. And the nominal target of this is Fidel Castro, which justifies this stuff. But when you wind up with people like Jack Ruby dying before he can be retried out of Dallas and stuff, you realize that they may have had other objectives for it. But what they did in the summer of 1963 was, once they repurposed this mission to kill Fidel Castro, they started testing it on monkeys, first South American monkeys and then African monkeys. And they finally had to test it on a human. And so there's this story of Oswald being seen in late August in Clinton, Louisiana, on a day when the Congress on Racial Equality is holding a voter registration drive. Well, this is pretty easy to nail down the date if you do a little gumshoe work on it, because the 28th of August, 1963, was the day Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech, okay? And they all knew, the Congress on Racial Equality knew this was coming, because it was the 8th anniversary of the Emmett Till murder in Mississippi, where they lynched this little black teenager from Chicago. And they were all prepared for black voter registration drives in these Klan-controlled towns. So CORE was, on August 29th, was holding a black voter registration drive in Clinton, Louisiana, when this black Cadillac shows up in the middle of the square. And, you know, you got the angry whites on one side and then blacks in the line to vote, and this black Cadillac comes in. So the marshal goes over and he tells the driver, "Show me your ID." And the guy says, "Sure, I'm Clay Shaw from the International Trademark."
Huh.
And then and we know this from congressional testimony now. I mean, that's, you know, they kept it secret from us for 16 years. But out of the back seat of the car, this young white guy gets up and he goes and stands in line with the blacks to see if they'll let him register to vote just because he's white. And he actually goes and signs in, and his name is Lee H. Oswald.
There he is.
There he is.
He was everywhere.
And he was getting out of a car driven by Clay Shaw. Now, if you remember the Oliver Stone movie, you know, Clay Shaw is the guy that that Jim Garrison accused of being associated with.
Played by Tommy Lee Jones, if I remember.
Absolutely right. And so that's a real connection. We've got law enforcement testimony on it given to Congress, and Congress took it in secret session and did not reveal it to the American people until 16 years later when the Oliver Stone movie came out. Now, what's interesting is there's also reports of Oswald being seen in Jackson, Louisiana, which is right down the road. Now, Jackson, Louisiana is where the mental hospital is, where the East Louisiana State Hospital is. And it's very clear from a number of books that the doctors were taking black patients out of Angola Penitentiary and bringing them over to this mental hospital to test them, various things on them. And when they were ready to test this biological weapon they had developed for Fidel Castro, they got some prisoners out of Angola and they brought them over to Jackson, Louisiana, which is why Clay Shaw and Oswald were in Clinton that day. They were waiting for the van to come over. They were waiting by the payphone for a phone call to say the van had left. And they went over and followed the van in to the mental hospital and injected this guy with this biological weapon. Well, they had to find out if the biological weapon took. Okay, so 2 days later, they drive a specialist, who's Judith Berry Baker, is one of the few people in the country at the time who knows how to do these blood tests on cancer patients to find out if the cancer is kicked in. Lee drives her all the way from New Orleans, 4.5 hours north and up to Jackson, Louisiana, and gets her inside of the mental hospital. Again, this is a hospital for the criminally insane, right? So it's got fences and barbed wire and guards and all this other stuff around it. So you don't just wander in to see Aunt Nellie. You got to pick up an employee and have a reason and all this other stuff. But they sneak Judith Berry Baker in to do the blood test on the patients. And this happens 2 days after the 29th. This is August 31st. And Oswald is seen at the barber shop. He goes in to get some information. He goes out and talks to a state representative there at his home. I mean, he's leaving a trail. He's saying, I was here. And this is when they test the biological weapon on live human beings.
So this weapon, though, this biological, was developed, you think, primarily to kill Fidel Castro?
Well, that was the excuse they used. That's what they told everybody involved to get them to do it, right? But I think it's a harebrained scheme. I mean, how are you going to get it into Castro, you know? I mean, they thought they had doctors in Cuba that might work with them and stuff like that. But what happens later is they start using it to kill people like Jack Ruby, you know? And so the rationale for the biological weapon doesn't necessarily, what they told the people doesn't necessarily have to be what they really wanted it for, but they did tell the people they were using it to kill Fidel Castro.
I just had LeVar Waldron on the program as we talked about the JFK assassination, and he is convinced that the New Orleans mobster Carlos Marcello had everything to do with JFK's assassination. And Oswald knew him, did he not?
Oh, Oswald knew him both historically from his family, because, you know, Oswald's father died before he was born. So he was raised by his uncle, Dutz. This is his family. Some people pronounce it Dutz, but it's Dutz Moret or Dutz Moret. And he grew up in that family, okay? And Dutz Moret was Carlos Marcello's best friend back from when they both worked on the docks. And so he had a long-standing historical connection to the mob. In fact, I had a client, you know, I worked in advertising, I had a client in New Orleans who told me he used to work with the mafia in New Orleans. He said, I ran 13 bars on Bourbon Street. And he stopped and he looked at me and he said, you know that Oswald kid? He was with us. He worked for us. And when he was a teenager, he, you know, ran stuff between these various restaurants and bars and all this stuff. So he definitely had one foot in the mob. And then when he comes back to New Orleans that summer, one of the things he does is he takes Judith and two other people over to the 500 Club to meet Carlos Marcelo, okay? Because they're setting up a gun smuggling thing because they're trying to bring in some rifles that they can use to give to the Cubans that cannot be traced back to the United States.
Because Marcelo and Traficante, they were all assets of the CIA, weren't they?
That's right. You have Operation Mongoose, which is very important in this. And what Operation Mongoose was a deliberate setup between the CIA and the mafia for the purpose of killing Fidel Castro. Okay, and what we have in this photo that everyone keeps talking about that's got Rafael Cruz in it, I can name, if you don't count Oswald as part of Mongoose, I can name three other people in the photo who were part of Operation Mongoose, okay? And what they were doing there was they were bringing weapons into town. I'm talking about things like machine guns and silenced rifles and those type of things to supply to the Cubans, you know, for the anti-Castro activities.
Give me, if you could, Ed, your gut feeling synopsis of what all this is. Just tie it all together for me. What do you think was planned? And was this all the setup to kill Kennedy? Even Jimmy Hoffa might have been part of that. What do you think all this was?
Well, there was a plot to kill Kennedy. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or
buts. I mean, this whole thing is like intertwined with all kinds of things, isn't it?
Well, that's right, and it is a complex thing. But you know, Kennedy really thought he was president. I mean, he really thought he could take on the power in the country, and everybody would rally behind him, and all that other stuff, and. What he was doing was really, pardon the language, pissing off the people with power, okay? And so you've got to look at things like, you know, when people say the mob did it, oh, well, the mob didn't change the parade route and mess with the media, and you know, but the mob may have killed Oswald as part of it. You know, I mean, I think that was Jack Ruby was.
Well, they had to shut him up. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, well, can you think of what Oswald could have said if he got in?
Oh, my God, he could have implicated all of them.
That's right.
And all of them got off scot-free.
Right.
Once Oswald got killed.
Right, and he could have talked all about the biological weapon. You imagine how much that would have freaked people out. You know,
the sacrificial lamb was Jack Ruby.
Well, yeah, Jack Ruby was just told, you know, as Jim Garrison said, Jack, baby, you know, we need a favor, you know. Jack was told to go in and kill him, you know. And what you realize is that Oswald was supposed to be transferred from the police department over to the courthouse at like 10 o'clock in the morning, and they had the media there and everybody was ready. Why didn't they bring him out? Because Ruby wasn't there. Ruby didn't show up until, I mean, literally, when Ruby went in the Western Union office next door and came out, that was the cue. May I have the envelope, please? Where's Oswald? Bring him out. Because once Oswald was coming out, all the eyes were on Oswald, all the cameras were on Oswald, the lights were on, and Jack Ruby walked up to the back of the crowd with nobody seeing him there, pulled his gun, and shot Oswald. He was not standing in the crowd.
Now, let's go back to Mary Sherman for a moment, the doctor who was murdered.
Right.
Why bump her off?
Well, it depends on who bumped her off, you know. And if a number of people, including retired FBI agents and stuff, have said to me they killed her to shut her up. Well, she was killed in 1964, about a year after the assassination. If you want to kill somebody, there's lots of easier ways to do it than burning off their arm, you know? So I don't think that killing her, I think what they wanted to do was expose, I mean, the Warren Commission was there that day starting their investigation, and Oswald had documents on him that they thought came from the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital. Well, that's the very place where the linear particle accelerator was. And I think what happened was they sabotaged the particle accelerator, and Mary Sherman just happened to be the person that was there and happened to be the person that got her arm blown off. right? But they couldn't leave her there because they would expose not only this secret medical Manhattan Project, but they would expose the identity of everybody else involved in it, which was some of the most powerful people in America.
So she was in the wrong place?
Well, she was part of the wrong operation, but, you know, they sabotaged the machine that she was working on, and that's what burned off her arm. And once her arm was burned off, she was still alive.
Right. She was also stabbed, though, wasn't she?
Yes, but she was still alive after her arm was burned off, but she wasn't going to make it, okay? So somebody did a mercy killing. They just stabbed her in the heart to get it over with, and then they got her in a body bag, and they brought her back to her apartment, and they faked the murder scene. Again, this is why they didn't tell anybody about the arm being missing, because they didn't want people going around looking for the machine.
When you said earlier that Lee Harvey Oswald was flushing toilets, what was he doing?
Well, in August of 63, you know, they had this lab at David Ferry's apartment. Across the street was what we call the Mouse House, where they had several thousand mice in cages. And they were killing mice and cutting out their tumors. It was all part of this cancer research thing. And they went from killing 50 mice a day up until August, where they were killing like 500 mice a day. And it was Judith Ferry Baker and Lee Oswald standing in David Ferry's apartment together that were doing this. And Judy would prepare the test tubes and the slides and everything else and put them in a lunchbox, and she was taking them over to Mary Sherman's apartment. Well, Mary Sherman's apartment was getting loaded up with all these test tubes and all this cancer virus and stuff, and they had to get rid of it, okay? So
it's bizarre to have all that in an apartment, isn't it?
That's right, but there was a guy down the sidewalk from Mary Sherman's apartment named Juan Valdez, and Oswald would go over and see Juan Valdez. And we have the witness who lived next door to Juan Valdez.
That's not the coffee guy, is it?
No.
Same name.
Same.
And didn't Lee Harvey?
Lots of people in Latin America call Juan Valdez.
Well, right? And didn't Lee Harvey Oswald work at a coffee shop?
Yes, at not a coffee shop. He worked at a coffee importer. Which is why they were also anti-communist, because they were concerned about, you know, Shea and the revolution taking over all their coffee fields and stuff. But what you had there was Oswald would go over there, and this woman, Victoria, who lived next door to Juan Valdez, her headboard of her bed was up against a wall, and the other side of the wall was Juan Valdez's bathroom. And this gal, Victoria, she went to middle school with Lee Oswald. She knew him. She recognized him when he would walk past her apartment going into Juan Valdez's place. And every time he would go in there, they would start flushing the toilet like 20 or 30 times in a row.
Weird.
And she was telling me this. I said, wait a second. How many times did this happen? Like once? And she said, no, this was like every night throughout August.
All right, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment, Ed, and take some phone calls and continue chatting about truly this bizarre episode. But, you know, I'm at a point now where I'm concluding that a lot of this did originate in New Orleans. I think the prosecutor at the time, Jim Garrison, was right on when he put this all together. He had it down. We're going to be back.